Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. Today I'm with George Farkas. He's the CEO of an electronics engineering service company in the Pacific Northwest called Tasuga Engineering. His company creates portable power components for electronic devices, such as integrated power in backpacks and business cases. Over his career, George has helped several companies develop products that provide customers great value. George, I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today and sharing some of your product innovation experience and insights with my listeners.
Well, hi, Chad. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's a great privilege.
Delighted to be talking with you. We met a while ago in one of the study groups I was doing. At the time, I believe you were preparing for the MPDP, the New Product Development Professional certification.
That's right.
And that's PDMA certification. This is like acronym alphabet soup here. PDMA is the Product Development and Management Association, and I have a study group program for them. And a few weeks ago, I had emailed all the past customers that I've worked with to let them know that I was doing a blog and providing tips about product development, management, innovation, and the such at the everydayinnovator.com, and was actually quite surprised by the response to that. Several people had emailed back thanking for that information, but you picked up the phone, and you must have picked up the phone right after I had sent it, and was kind of blown away that you did that as the CEO of a company, and we ended up talking for about 30 minutes. Why did you take time to do that?
Chad, it was great to hear from you, and you and I had started work on a potential project some time ago. It was a great opportunity to reconnect, and I'd been meaning to reach out to you, and that was just a great reminder to do so.
I appreciate that. And maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later, too. I know you went into great depth about the importance of innovation management training and how this really drives economies and drives company success. So no doubt you have seen that in your efforts and the company that you're with now. I'd like to get a background on people I talk with. A lot of people listen are moving into the area of product management or trying to improve their skills in that space. And we tend to come from a number of different kinds of backgrounds. Tell me, is there a theme that kind of ran through your life as you were growing up and through school and your early experiences that kind of ties together why you ended up being an innovator today?
Thanks, Chad. I'm not sure, but like all kids, like every kid, I think we were always obsessed with different kinds of activities and different projects. And as kids, we were rock climbers, and rock climbing really took over our lives, ultimately developed into more complex things like mountain climbing, alpine mountain climbing. And I guess they're obsessive activities that are really about taking risks and about managing risks. And I suppose that had some play later on in life. And I suppose that also the fact that you had to do everything as a team, right? You had to work well as a team with whoever's on the other end of your rope, requires a high degree of trust, and it also just requires developing a good relationship skills.
Absolutely.
Or collaborativity.
Yeah, lots of collaboration, right? So risk is an interesting aspect. A lot of people look at entrepreneurs and those of us that are developing products as maybe risk takers. And, my experience has actually been kind of the opposite. We're much better at boxing risk and defining what the risk is and taking action to minimize the risk facing us. I suspect, the closest I've gotten to rock climbing is a few years of time in a rock gym. That was great fun, but nothing like what you've been doing. And risk is very meaningful because life is on the line when you're in settings like that.
Right. You're making an assumption that the risk is something that you're going to be able to manage, right? Which is already seemingly an audacious assumption at the very beginning. But get your hands into it and start to manage that and start to figure out that you really can manage that risk. That builds a lot of self-confidence, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Good. And carry that into the leading companies and groups now.
Sure.
So what kind of roles have you had that have worked together to do the product development management work that you're doing now? Are there ones that stand out you can share with us?
I've moved through and I guess blended different sales management and marketing management and product development roles in various companies. And as I was working on my professional education in product innovation, and I guess the value in blending those roles was being able to do everything holistically, if that makes sense, with a team of people. You met with the customers and prospects to gather information, to do the face-to-face research. You then developed prototype samples, and then you went back to the customer to either confirm or adjust your product samples. And only then did you actually go into production. So there was a huge advantage in not being isolated in a silo. You're actually meeting face-to-face.
So as a blended role, how did that come about? What were you doing? Because a lot of people don't have that experience where they're really in a blended role across those traditional silos in a company.
Good question. I suspect that that has to do also with the size of the given company that you're working with, or perhaps in some cases the age if it's a relatively new company. You know, as companies become larger, of course, by necessity, those silos have to become more carefully defined and our roles become much more siloed, if that's a word. But as in a smaller company or a younger or growing company, you often have to wear multiple hats. And so I think that was very fortunate. Those experiences were very fortunate ones for me.
Absolutely. You know, we share that kind of experience. My first job out of college as an electrical engineering student was with a small system engineering company where I was the fourth person in the office. And, you know, over the years, we grew it up quite a bit. But when there's only four of you, you tend to do a lot of everything. Right? Mm-hmm. And you're right. You have blended roles where you see a lot of different kind of operations.
Sure.
What a great environment to learn.
You know, you also pick up the advantage of you're working on the marketing from the very beginning and you're seeing what resonates with your sample customers. And then you can focus on that for your actual final marketing outreach or launch. It's actually based. So, you know, all those streams are running in parallel. All the development is running in parallel, whether it's product or marketing or what have you. And that's a huge, huge advantage.
I should get your feedback on something. So sometimes I'm asked by people in larger companies, you know, how do I get that kind of blended experience? How do I learn about the functions, recognizing that I want to move into product management? It's a really cross-functional role, what to do. And I tell them, gosh, you know, you got 5 days in the week, carve out at least one of those to have lunch with someone in another function and just reach out to them. If you don't know them, reach out to them, say, you know, this is what I'm doing. I'm curious what goes on inside your role and what that function is like, and start building that professional network inside your company and learning what the other roles do. Thoughts on that advice?
I'd have to think about that. I don't know that I've got a, you know, always love what the legendary quote about the development of the new Apple headquarters where all the bathrooms are in the central hall.
Right.
No bathrooms anywhere else. So everyone has to inadvertently meet and run into each other in this sort of main hall space. And so you wind up building some of those networks automatically. I don't know, but I think your advice seems great.
I love that too. It's the new virtual water cooler, right? Now we've centralized bathrooms, so everyone has to get together to meet. So a blended role, you mentioned sales management, which I think is a great experience for product managers to have, because we learn how to talk to customers and appreciate, you know, their voice and bringing that back to our organization. You talked about having to verify, you know, the ideas, make sure you're building the right sort of product for them. What about a specific story? Can you dive into lessons that you learned on one of your projects?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about product development examples. And, you know, it's so funny. It sounds so simple when you say it, but it's like we know that the winning formula is always to develop with the best interests of the customers in mind. And that the only way to do that right is to study the customer, to determine what develop, and to collaborate, right, as a team to develop that. And then that, you know, reliably produces market winners, or at least it reduces the risk of not producing a market winner. But it's the projects that you did differently that are the ones that really stick in your mind, right? I think certainly for both of us in our conversations. And the ones that, you know, there's some of the zingers that stand out in my mind. So these are projects that were not successful. There are things that they're based on aggregate data or aggregate market data driven projects, you know, where, I mean, you probably see it. I certainly do throughout the industries in which we work, where so many products are based on aggregate market data, but they're done in isolation from real customers. And it seems like the best thing that you can hope for, and that is basically a me too product that is probably going to be a poor performer if you're lucky, right? Or a failure if you're not. And it's a difficult thing, right? Remember, you have to remember why the market data is available, right? It's available because the category is already mature, right? Which means it's all already probably saturated with competitors.
Right.
So you're coming in, if market data is available, that means you're coming in late to the game, which means you better have some special direct customer insight that you're applying to either your product or your service that gives you a fighting chance in a very saturated environment. So, you know, I've consulted on some teams that were directed to develop products based on aggregate data alone, and it's an eerie feeling. Maybe you've experienced this, but the team is working towards something that you have in your gut is a sense that it's very likely going to fail.
Why is that an eerie feeling? Tell me more about that.
Maybe it's because, at least in my examples, in my experience, I'd come from a situation where we had done product development based on face-to-face VOC research or ethnographic research, and now was put into a new circumstance, in this case, a consulting circumstance, where the company just wanted to do it differently and really just wanted to do it based exclusively on the market data and just go, go, go. And, you know, time pressure is often the excuse for that, right? We've got to get this product shipping by such and such a date, or we've got a particular trade show coming up. So there's no time to do the kind of face-to-face customer research that you're talking about. And the other line that's almost always included in there is the quote, and somehow it's always the same words, besides, we know what the customer needs, is the other phrase. But, you know, the team is trying to do their best to believe in the project, right? And they're putting in real hard work on the project, and the company's investing real money in that project. But the product was never vetted, really, with the actual end users. At least it wasn't vetted in any professional way. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you know, the product is often a disappointment or a total failure, and you wind up wasting years.
Yes, serious effort, and possibly harming a reputation and letting down customers that you otherwise could have provided value to. I suspect we both have seen companies where the product managers routinely are not provided the opportunity to talk with customers. I know I've been in organizations where they're flat out told, no, that's not what you do. You know, we, in your example, you know, we have this aggregate data. We're trying to build a Me Too product to keep up with the competitors, and they're not allowed out of the office. How do you feel about that?
I mean, we know from our experience that there are much, much better processes that which we should be following. I suspect that this starts to lead into the larger conversation about corporate culture and building a culture that supports innovation. It's very difficult to do any one thing right out of the larger context of professional innovation environment. So obviously the team that's developing the product has got to have face-to-face time with the customers and has got to know how to do the research in a structured way to really come away with economically valid data.
So on your example here of your zinger that, you know, wasn't so successful, I don't know if you can share any more specifics of how this came about. You know, the focusing on the aggregate data, sound like there was time pressure in this example, maybe wanting to reduce development costs in the first place, not taking time to spend money on the market research and the customer research.
Yeah, and to be fair, you know, everyone here was working in good faith, and everyone was putting their heart into it, and everyone had good intentions. But as you know, there's that phrase path dependence, that if you make a certain set of assumptions at the very beginning, your path then becomes dependent 6 months later and a year later and 2 years later based on those original assumptions.
Right.
And if those assumptions were off, then, you know, you're suffering a year and 2 years later because of that. And in this case, this was the development of a very expensive luggage collection, and it was based on a snapshot of market data, kind of a down-selected snapshot of market data. And the project was pushed, and there was just no time to do, you know, ethnographic work or VOC work because it was a very complicated process to build. This was a very expensive development process. It was some very, very expensive tooling. It was a big, expensive marketing project to launch. And it was a couple of years worth of work by a great team. Like I said, everyone doing their best, but the product bombed and had to be basically swept under the rug after the original launch. Just, you know, several months after the launch, it just absolutely bombed.
Wow. Isn't there some irony there to learn from? And that I think we see this too many times, that as you told that story, it sounded like there was a large emphasis on recognizing this was a big project. We had to get manufacturing tooled up for it. We were doing things differently. There was a lot at stake for this.
Right.
So because we're going to spend all this much money later in the design and manufacturing process, we don't have the time or the money to spend it up front understanding the requirements, right? And that's where the irony is, you know, that...
Right. And to be fair, right, there's always that sense that, you know, but we know what the customer wants, or we know what the customer needs, and that, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're exactly right. Yeah.
I know on the projects I've been involved with the ones that were most comfortable for me, you know, you made that statement, just kind of felt airy, felt, you know, in my words, you know, scary, uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. The projects that have been most comfortable were the ones where I really felt like I was in the shoes of the customer, right? I'm not really trying to be them, but I am representing their perspective to the organization, right? To the product team.
Sure.
And trying to bring in the product team to really see that for themselves. And it's the projects where I am least comfortable, where we have that aggregate data, or maybe we have the request from a customer, you know, saying, here's the list of requirements, but that's always uneasy for me, right? If the customer's told us what they need, we probably don't have a real clear understanding actually of what the customer needs, what their actual problem is, and how we can truly add value to what they need.
Right, right. That face-to-face structured research is not simply sitting down and asking them, what do they want? It's a whole structured process by which you can actually uncover unmet needs that they may not be able to articulate.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think we all struggle with articulating our unmet needs. So what are your tips for that? What have you done in the past that makes that helpful?
Again, ironically, and kind of like you were saying, these processes that skip the upfront research are typically done in the name of saving time and saving money. So, you know, ultimately, it sort of behooves the senior executives to be aware that the how this process works, to at least have kind of a good working knowledge of how the process works, and also a respect and need for it, and an ability to establish it and help it flourish mm-hmm. in our companies, and to support that innovation process, and to sort of insist that throughout the company that process is being supported. There really isn't a good way around it. The alternative is really you just keep crashing and burning, or you rely on Me Too products and you underperform financially.
Yep. Yeah. So that desire to skip the upfront process to save time and money for the sake of making a more successful project in the end is truly folly, right? I'm sure there's times where we would find aggregate market data to be useful. We could develop a Me Too product that would satisfy the objectives of the organization. But if we're really betting the farm, or if we're trying to, in a portfolio of projects, have a truly innovative project, that's not how we get there. You know, it's that customer research, customer insights.
Right. And to be fair, right, the market research provides very important secondary information. So we need it, but it just doesn't guide the fine details of the development process. And I suppose, to be fair to the executives, you have to wonder how many MBA programs include good coursework on the product development process, on the current best practices in product development, not so that the executive has to become the product developer, but so that the executive has an understanding of how to manage the product development process in their organization later. So
where do you see the executive's role then in product innovation?
It seems like the executives, one of the key roles for the executive is establishing the company culture. And of course, we talk about culture needing to be in alignment with its strategy and in alignment with its innovation, in alignment with its business strategy and its innovation strategy. And that alignment needs to be throughout. I mean, every person, every job, every silo in the organization needs to be part of that team and be driving that and helping to drive that. So the executives really carry the responsibility for establishing that culture and for maintaining that culture of support for innovation.
So if you're going to give some coaching tips to another C-level person in the organization that came to you and said, you know, George, I'm really struggling with wanting to build an innovation culture, what kind of tips would you give them?
Boy, I'd have to think about that. I'd have to think about that.
So from your own experience, what's something that you've done as an executive to help you with product innovation?
You know, again, to get that education, at the very least, you've got to get enough of an education in best practices and innovation processes such that you can manage that process. You know, I hate to sound like a broken record there, but you have to know, just like in an MBA school, you get a certain amount of accounting instruction and a certain amount of other instruction for the other divisions of the organization. You've got to have some of that training yourself and know that it exists. So not even knowing that it exists and just assuming that everyone's guessing, so that anyone's guess is as good as anyone else's, that's a very tough place to be. It's not really a process.
Right. There was a large Fortune 500 companies a few years ago that I was doing some work with, and they decide as a executive team that they were going to reach their objectives with the heavy emphasis on new product development. The way they went around about that was to make available to everyone in all the silo departments new product development training. Right. And basically they were pursuing the same certification that you did, the MPDP. And that was, we're going to level set, build a foundation for everyone, have a similar set of terminology that we understand and processes. And it was open to everyone across the company. And there were some that were focused on, right, you, in the sense that you do need to get this training, you know, the product development team, some of the people from the marketing teams, but they were really pushing their innovation culture forward by just giving everyone the same information. So I thought that was.
And so how did that work out?
Unfortunately, we don't get to see the actual end of that story, because you've probably also seen this. There was about halfway through their plan, there was a change in the VP who was responsible for this. And when that happens, things go a different direction. So as they did in this case.
So I guess the consistency, I suppose, is a big part of this as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the other thing that always stands out to me is user experience. You know, it's like I've certainly, and perhaps you as well, have been involved with, either directly or on a consulting basis, products where the development team was forced to make bad compromises that effectively wrecked the user experience. And you hate to say it, but it's almost a pure Dilbert kind of situation, right? Because the product that you deliver on paper, the features are there.
Right.
But the user is irritating. Sorry, the user experience is irritating for some reason. And, you know, I recently watched a whole consumer brand fail in part, perhaps in large part for that reason, right? The product concept was actually great, but the products were ugly and hard to use. And the company internally had lots of reasons as to why that was the case. But then the customer didn't care. The customer regarded those things as excuses.
Right. What were some of those reasons? Why would they ignore or mishandle the user experience?
Good question. Part of it, perhaps actually one of the most common things that I'd heard in those conversations, was that the user needs to learn. The user needs to come to our level. We really expect the user to invest the time and energy in learning how to use our product. We're not going to try to work towards meeting the customer where they are. We want the customer to come to us and to meet us where we are and where we want to be. And we're going to deliver the product the way that we would design it for ourselves and not adapt it for what the customer's needs are.
Yeah, that's an uphill battle, right? It's similar to any time we have to educate the customer on the need for the product. We probably don't have the right product to really satisfy their needs. So, yeah, challenging. Sound like there might be a fair bit of arrogance also with that position.
Yeah, well, you know, again, knowing all the people involved and knowing that everyone was operating with really best intentions and, again, putting their hearts into it and then applying all their professional skill and training. But unfortunately, again, it was a path-dependent situation. Once certain decisions were made early on, then everyone just carried out their roles to 100%. But the problem was that it was, you know, flawed from the very beginning. The decisions made at the beginning, really.
That takes us back to the what you said before, that need of understanding up front what really adds value to the customer. And in this context, what is that user experience for the customer?
And I guess, you know, it's something we've talked about in the past is that it's also using that, the good data that you gather from face-to-face experience to overrule your own opinion and, frankly, anyone else's opinion within the organization. You're not designing the product based on opinions. You're designing it based on real user needs that you've worked quite hard to determine.
Yeah, that's risk management, right? Maybe that's some of the lessons from your climbing experiences that you apply now to product development. You
know, yeah, it might be.
Try and uncover real data in the customer experience to drive the direction of the product.
Absolutely.
Very good. So I appreciate you sharing the story a little bit about the luggage endeavor and how that did not work out as intended. Really kind of shortchanging that front-end process of working with the customer, understanding what the customer values, and taking that, often calling it the voice of the customer, that information back to the product development activity and verifying that with the customer you're on the right track. I also want to ask you about an innovation quote. And I like wrapping up interviews with innovation quotes because we tend to, you know, we all have our favorites and tend to find them motivating for some one reason or another. What's an innovation quote that's meaningful to you?
So I really like Fred Polansky's one of the executives at 3M, and he had a quote that I really liked. And I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, but this is what he said. Companies whose innovation processes are strong and whose cultures strongly support those processes possess a huge advantage. And it's important that the emphasis is on both elements. You both have very strong processes, but your culture also supports those processes, you know, across the silos, across the different disciplines within the organization. And you know, when product innovators talk about alignment, that's a very big part of what they're talking about. The whole company is aligned with that strategy and with that effort.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, we can have the right processes, but if the culture is not supportive, we tend to drive out innovation rather quickly.
Yeah, it seems like your customers only really care about their user experience with your product or service. They really don't care about the internal politics of your company.
It's a really good point. It's not about us. It is about the customer, right? And we're striving to create a culture and processes that enable us to build valuable products for them.
It's funny, you know, there's that great quote that bad is stronger than good in our minds or in people's minds. We tend to remember the times that you burned your hand on the stove, whatnot. You remember the difficult situations. And it's funny how, let's call them less innovative companies, all seem to have this story that everyone within the company knows about the one time that they tried to do something really innovative and it failed.
Right.
And I've certainly been in different companies and sat in meetings in different places where that story is retold at every meeting where something new is being discussed, right? And it does a very effective job of killing off new projects. Because the funny thing with that, and to really be fair, right, is that to some degree that it may be correct, right? Our process, such as it is, because it isn't really a very good process, doesn't produce winners.
Right.
And it's kind of it's an unfortunate way to draw that out, but it also, it's a showstopper too. It sort of, it ends the question. And it's sort of like I think there's a comment that you had made at one point, that a question that you had asked at one point in the past, is any process better than no process, right? Is any development process that whatever your company has, you know, put together better than not having a process at all? And, you know, to me, the easiest way to think about that is to ask the same question about accounting, right? And if you ask that question about accounting, the answer would be no, right? It needs to be the best process. There really isn't an alternative. You have to accounting best practices. And there's really no flexibility on that answer. It has to be done properly. So that's what I think about when I'm asked that question, when that question comes up.
Yeah, and I remember talking about that question. And if you don't have any process, then maybe that is your conclusion, right? So the company took a risk at one point to try to do something they considered innovative, and they failed terribly. Without any process, they can't even go back and analyze what that was, right? There was an implicit process because they tried something, but it wasn't anything they ever thought about, and it wasn't anything they can now put their hands around and try to improve. And so a process is better than nothing, because at least you have a point to start from to improve it. And maybe that might be some good advice too, back on the question about how do we help an organization be more innovative and create an innovation culture. I think telling that story is one thing that's helpful. You know, what do we lift up around this organization as the stories to help innovation? If we're sharing the story about the time that we tried something new and it failed miserably, we're certainly beating innovation out of the culture.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
So the stories we tell matter a lot.
Exactly. And, you know, you wonder, you know, what's the bottom line here, right? What is it fundamentally that matters? What are we trying to do? Mm-hmm. We're trying to, you know, economically benefit our companies, of course, and the people within our companies. And we're trying to benefit our customers, right? We want to give them the very best service or product that we can deliver for them. And we also, and I think it's really important that we all keep this in mind, we're trying to benefit the industries in which we work, the markets in which we work, and also the economy as a whole. And it all boils right back down to the quality of your innovation process, that all of these goods, right? This is a virtuous cycle, right? As opposed to a vicious cycle, this is a virtuous cycle that breeds good for your customers, good for your company team, and good for your markets or your industries. And then if we all do this all together, it does great things for our economy and the economy of the planet, really.
Absolutely. It's an important message. And that reminds me that when you called and we talked for 30 minutes a few weeks ago, that was much of our discussion, was how important truly innovation is, not just to the company itself. A lot of people involved in innovation, they do so because they love delighting customers, right? Solving problems that delight customers. But the bigger picture is, you know, this is what drives economies, and it's what pulls economies out from being slow and creating job opportunities. And it is an important aspect of business.
Right, exactly. You know, we do this for the greater good. And we do this both because there are wonderful new opportunities, things that can benefit people and our economies. You know, obviously, if you read the news, or, you know, obviously there are tremendous global challenges that we're all faced with right now. And innovation really is a toolbox and a set of tools that can be applied to any problem. And so, you know, that's really the most powerful tool set that we have.
Yep. Can't agree more. Innovation will solve the problems that we're facing. Very good. George, I really appreciate this discussion. It's been a great opportunity to learn from you and your product development experience. And I expect my listeners have also enjoyed it, and want to thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. And the listeners is why I do this show. I am all about helping product managers, developers, and innovators be more successful. And I want to sincerely thank you for listening. Please recommend this podcast to your colleagues and keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.